On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm Sej Deans, your moderator for this evening. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest. William Easterly is a professor of economics at New York University and co-director of the NYU Development Research Institute, which won the 2009 BBVA Frontiers of Knowledge in Development Cooperation Award. He is the author of three books, The White Man's Burden, The Elusive Quest for Growth, and The Tyranny of Experts, his newest one. He has also published more than 60 peer-reviewed academic articles and ranks among the top 100 most cited economists worldwide. Foreign Policy Magazine named him among the top 100 global public intellectuals in 2008 and 2009. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor William Easterly.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deanst. It's really a pleasure to be here with you tonight. We're talking about an important issue tonight. Around the world tonight, people are fighting for more freedom and more democracy. From Ukraine to Venezuela to Ethiopia to China, there are activists in the streets, there are dissidents in the jails fighting for freedom and democracy. It saddens me after 30 years as a development economist that too often we development economists, those of us who fight the global war on poverty, have been on the wrong side, that we've been too often on the side of the autocrats and not on the side of those who are fighting for their freedom. And what I want to do tonight is explain to you how that happened and how we could possibly change that. So this happened because of lots of well-intentioned people falling for three basic, simple myths. And I'm going to go through each one of these myths. The first one was that the myth of the technocratic solution to poverty. That poverty is basically a set of technical problems that the poor have that can be fixed with a technical solution. So, for example, preventing malaria. You can spray a chemical on the walls of houses to kill the mosquitoes that spread malaria. That's a technical solution that solves malaria. Malnutrition is often partly caused by vitamin deficiency. It's very cheap to distribute vitamin A capsules. Something like agriculture is often affected by poor soils, like soil erosion is caused by runoff of rainwater. That can be solved by terraces, by making terraces on highly sloped agricultural land. And lastly, it's very simple, seemingly, to get clean water. You just drill boreholes, drill wells to get water. So these seem like a very straightforward set of technical solutions that would end poverty if we just had enough money to do them. But the reason the technocratic solution is a myth is that it fails to ask two very important questions. One is the big question, who is going to be doing these technical solutions? And whoever they are, why didn't they do them already? If they were so easy to do and so straightforward, then why didn't they do them already? Well, the answer to the first question of who is to do them is usually some combination of development experts like me advising local governments in poor countries who are usually autocratic. So our basic model is wise experts from the West advising autocrats in the rest. We call that sort of technocratic development. That's the technocratic solution in action. That's the de facto way that these solutions are being put into practice. And then the question is, why haven't the solutions happened already? Well, the autocrats are not necessarily well motivated to deliver these solutions. Autocrats, we tend to make the hidden assumption that autocrats are benevolent and that if we just give them the advice they need to solve the problem, they will solve it. But the assumption of benevolence is kind of misplaced. But it is a very common one. Let me give you an example. USAID celebrated the ruler of Ethiopia, Meles Zenawi, He was the ruler of Ethiopia from 1991 till August of 2012, when he died of natural causes. And to be not mince words, he was a dictator. I was actually very sad that he died, because he was kind of my favorite example of a technocratic dictator. And now I've lost my favorite example. I sent flowers to his funeral. I was so sad. So USAID, during when he was still alive, said that Meles Zenawi had made, quote, tremendous progress transforming Ethiopia's economy and society. World Bank President Dr. Jim Kim joined the chorus. He said Ethiopia ruler Meles had made transformational change. And another man in a city that I just visited on this trip, Seattle, Bill Gates, said that Meles Zenawi had made, quote, real progress in helping the people of Ethiopia. And Mr. Gates actually sent out, now, by the way, these guys are well-intentioned guys. I'm not, everything I say tonight, I'm really respecting the good intentions of everyone involved. I'm going to try to explain how we get to these myths. So Mr. Gates really set out clearly that the heart of the technocratic approach. He said that the experts and the government, he said this in an article in the Wall Street Journal a year ago, that they set, quote, clear goals, they choose an approach, they measure results, and then they use these measurements to continually refine our approach, our meaning we, the experts, and the government, the autocrats. So technocrat is literally a word that means, technocracy is a word that literally means ruled by experts. It was a made-up word in the early 20th century when we started to have more faith in experts, that maybe we should just turn everything over to the experts, which is, we did not wind up doing wholesale in the U.S., but we have done in development. And then Bill Gates closed this by saying, this helps us to deliver, helps us, the experts who are in charge, to deliver tools and services to everybody who will benefit. But then, of course, we still are stuck with the second question, why were the technical solutions not already done? Why is Ethiopia so poor to begin with? Could it have something to do with Meles Zenawi's 20 years of autocratic rule preceded by 30 years of a previous autocratic ruler, preceded by Haile Selassie, preceded by other indigenous autocrats, preceded by the slave trade which oppressed Ethiopia for so long? So a very long history of autocracy is part of the reason that Ethiopia is poor. The autocrat is not the solution to Ethiopia's poverty, he is the cause of Ethiopia's poverty. We have other kind of direct, to stay on this example, we have other kind of direct evidence that Meles Zenawi was not so benevolent. In 2010, Human Rights Watch documented how Meles systematically withheld aid finance famine relief from anyone who was not a member of the ruling party. And then what really shows the kind of technocratic approach that does not recognize poor people's rights, what really shows the forgotten rights of the poor, are two non-events that happened after Human Rights Watch exposed that manipulation of aid. First, the donors, which included USAID and the World Bank and the British Aid Agency, they first promised to investigate when there was this Human Rights Watch documented this manipulation of famine relief. And then nothing happened. There were actually two nothing happens. First, the donors did not investigate. There was later a cable that was uncovered by WikiLeaks that said, you know, we don't want to investigate because, you know, Meles is our ally in the war on terror. And the other non-event was that nobody protested this non-investigation. Nobody even noticed this non-investigation of a major breach of human rights that was directly financed by foreign aid. That shows just how forgotten are the rights of the poor and how much we are focused on technocratic solutions. So the alternative to autocracy is individual rights. Now, we have pretty well-known theories in economics and politics of how individual rights can cause some pretty good outcomes in society. First of all, this is really elementary stuff, but, you know, just because it's elementary doesn't mean that it's not part of a solution to a really complex, big problem. It's sort of elementary politics and economics 101 that a democratic ruler who's responsible and accountable to the voters will be more likely to do things that make the voters happy. Whereas an autocrat who gained power through coercion and repression has no such incentive. So that's just kind of 101. So Melissa Nawi can get away with, you know, starving the opposition and not giving them famine relief. Yeah, in our democracy, there is a New Jersey governor who could not even get away with a traffic jam on a bridge. A lot less serious than denying famine relief to a starving opposition party dissident. That's our democracy in action. That kind of threat of political heat makes our governments behave. Governments don't naturally behave. They only behave when we force them to, by our democratic rights. Our rights of free speech, of freedom of the media, our rights to protest, to call our congressmen, to vote them out of office, all of the above makes our governments behave and do good things and stop doing bad things. And the other thing that they do is they protect our economic rights, which also allows private sector entrepreneurs to provide some of those technical fixes. And they are also accountable to their consumers, because they, if they succeed, they will get rewarded with higher profits and stock market valuations. And if they fail, then they get punished with lower profits or bankruptcy or driven out of business. And so a free society that has both political and economic rights is a great decentralized problem-solving society in which a combination of political problems, public problem solvers and private problem solvers get rewarded for solving problems. And that's why technical fixes do happen and did happen in our society. And they are not happening in poor societies. That's very simple, and I will have lots of caveats that I'd be happy to address during Q&A. But that's the kind of simple vision that should give us clarity on how important our individual rights are. Now, why didn't we apply such simple principles in development? Well, that has to do with the second myth that I'm going to talk about, the myth of the blank slate. After the end of colonialism, around the beginning of the 60s, there was this idea that development was a new problem, that we had to come up with something new to get poor countries to get from poverty to prosperity. And we had to develop new theories, and our theory basically became the technocratic theory that I described in the first myth, the myth of the technocratic experts advising the autocrats solving the problems of the poor. What we forgot is that there were a set of countries that had already developed. Japan, North America, Western Europe. So there was really this very strange decision at the beginning of development to, you know, we were going to study the question of how to succeed at development, but we were going to exclude as possible models anyone who had succeeded at development. It's kind of complicated. Shall I go over that again? Why would you want to exclude those who had succeeded at development when you were trying to figure out how to succeed at development? Well, part of the reason is another part of the blank slate. We also forgot the history of technocratic development. It actually did not start after the end of colonialism. It actually started during colonial times. And part of the original justification for colonialism and for the technocratic solution and for not using the first world as models for development was, frankly, during colonial times, let's not mince words, the colonialists were so racist that they could not imagine that the solutions that work for us rich people would also work for poor people. They couldn't imagine that poor people were just like us, except without money. And so during colonial times, the technocratic model was also the preferred model. In fact, there was a report prepared in 1938 by a British colonial official named Lord Hayley that was a technocratic masterpiece. And it put forth solutions that actually are very similar to those that appeared 70 years later in a United Nations report. And actually, I very sneakily already mentioned those solutions. So the 1938 report, which is 1,837 pages long, it's a good read. If you don't want to read it, then I will summarize it for you. So it came up with technical solutions like spraying chemicals inside houses to kill the malarial mosquitoes, like distributing vitamin A capsules for malnutrition. Does this start to sound a little bit familiar? Using terraces to reduce soil erosion, drilling boreholes and wells for clean water. These were already in the 1938 report. And then they showed up again 70 years later in another very long, thousands of page long UN report in 2005. I don't remember exactly who was the author of the UN report. I think it was Angelina Jolie. But so one thing we learned from that is that it wasn't a shortage of technical solutions that was causing poverty, because we already knew them 70 years ago. It was the technocratic, autocratic power of the colonialists that did not have the incentive to actually make these things work, that did not actually have the incentive to deliver these solutions, which is why we're still starting with a blank slate 70 years later and acting as if, for the first time in history, we're applying these technical solutions to the problems of the poor, technical solutions that have already been around for seven decades. So what was, of course, useful to the British about this... Oh, that's okay. That's okay. Tell them you'll call them back later. What was very useful about the technocratic approach is it was actually a great justification for colonialism. As racism started to become politically unacceptable, then you could no longer say, you know, we're British are ruling Africa because they're a superior race, which is what they used to say. They started to say, we're ruling Africa because we're the ones with the technical solutions that are going to develop Africa. And they even said explicitly, you know, we need to first solve poverty before we can give Africans political rights. We need to first address their critical material needs before they can get political rights, like wanting to run their own countries. This is a theme that is going to keep recurring throughout the next, you know, 60 years of development history, even after the end of colonialism. This theme that you have to first address the material needs of the poor, and the sort of political rights are something that comes much later as an after you have technocratically solved the material needs of the poor. So once we look behind the blank slate, which turns out not to be blank, but be full of this history of both successful free development in the rich countries and unsuccessful technocratic in the colonial countries, we see a clear record of success and failure. But we also see what was temporarily a good justification for the British Empire. And then after the British Empire ended, it turned out to be an equally good justification for the new autocratic rulers in Africa that took over. One sad thing about autocracy is that a history of autocracy often leads to more autocracy. So a long history of colonial autocracy set the stage for indigenous autocracy by the new rulers of Africa. There was no democratic tradition to go on. And so the new rulers of Africa were also autocrats. And now they were the benevolent autocrats that were going to be implementing the technical solutions that were part of the first myth that I talked about. So, you know, it was like what used to be the divine right of kings in the medieval religious times. In our times, it's the development right of dictators. Dictators justify their rule by being the ones who develop their countries, by being the benevolent autocrats who develop their countries. And we go along with this because, frankly, it's easier to just assume that the government you're working with is good, and it simplifies our problem as development experts to just hand them a list of technical solutions. And it also is very hard to resist because it gives us, the experts, a very powerful role. And I can speak to this personally because I myself was an expert, a development expert, for 16 years working for the World Bank. And ever since, I've been sort of a expert in recovery, a recovering expert. I've sort of been in recovery now for a long time. I still go to my local chapter of Authoritarians Anonymous every Wednesday night in the church basement. But, you know, we have to get over ourselves that we, the experts, don't have all the answers. And that's a very hard process to go through, to realize that you are not all the saviors, you are not the ones who has all the answers for poor people. But then there's one last myth that makes us believe in benevolent autocrats. And it's actually one of the biggest reasons that people believe in benevolent autocrats. It's very hard to overcome this belief. And I'll summarize the evidence for benevolent autocrats that is part of this myth with one word. China. China's an authoritarian country. It's had remarkable economic growth. And there's also a couple of other countries I'll talk about also in this example. South Korea was an authoritarian country that had remarkable economic growth. So this is one of the strongest reasons that people believe in benevolent autocrats, so that this, the myth of authoritarian growth miracles. Now, how could I possibly question that? What could be so plain than an autocrat presiding over wonderful economic growth that's lifting China and South Korea out of poverty? Well, I'm going to argue that it's not quite what it seems. Let's first of all think back to the basic idea of how rights solve poverty. What does that predict? It predicts that a high level of freedom would produce a high level of prosperity. That's a very simple prediction, that a high level of political and economic rights for people will produce a high level of prosperity. Now then, the next step you have to take is, if that's true, then a change in freedom would produce a change in prosperity. So if levels predict levels, then changes predict changes. This is not real advanced mathematics. I think everyone gets it. And so why are we excited about China? If China were being considered for its level of income, it would actually be considered a failure. It's much, much poorer than the U.S. and Western Europe and Japan. But the reason we're excited about it is the change. And what that change actually corresponds to is a positive change in freedom in China. So a little bit of positive change in political freedom and a lot of positive change in economic freedom. So even political freedom in China, although still very bad, in very bad shape today, is certainly much better than it was under Mao, during the time of the Great Leap Forward, the Great Famine that killed tens of millions, during the time of the Cultural Revolution that coerced and oppressed hundreds of thousands of people. The political rights of Chinese people today are much greater than they were in those dark times. And second, there was a peasant resistance movement that eventually led to a great increase in economic rights. The peasants started rebelling after the death of Mao against the collective farms. There's a great book about this by Kate Zhao called How the Farmers Changed China. So she quotes a farmer couple that lived in a very poor province of China that wrote these words to their local party cadre. They said, quote, "No one wants us because we are so poor. We have an idea to get rid of poverty, which is to divide the land of the collective farm and allocate it to the household. We'll pay 4.5 yuan per mu to the collective team if the team just leaves us alone." And so a party cadre accepted this deal. They were suffering great starvation at that time on the collective farm, but they immediately were able to produce much more food on their individual family plot. Their neighbors noticed they wanted the same deal. Then the neighboring villages wanted the same deal. Then the neighboring provinces wanted the same deal. And 30 years later, we've had a great increase in individual ownership in China that has been belatedly accepted by the Communist Party rulership. That's a positive change in economic freedom that is a big part of China's economic growth. So changes predict changes. A positive change in freedom produced miraculous economic growth, starting from a miserably low level that had been caused by Chinese long history of autocracy in the first place. The second example I'm going to give you of a changes story is South Korea. So South Korea's also experienced a lot of a positive change in economic freedom, even when it was controlled by autocrats. These autocrats were progressively giving up more and more of their own power to repress and control the economic activities of the population. There are much greater economic rights that led to a great trade boom, and things like the emergence of Hyundai as the world's fourth largest automaker, started by a peasant from a famine-prone village in North Korea. And then South Korea took the next step, and they did so thanks to one individual that you probably have not heard of, but played a remarkable, pivotal role. It shows the power of individuals to change history. His name was Park Jong-chul. He was only 21 years old. He was a student at Seoul National University. democracy activist that had was starting and leading and joining the emerging student democracy movement at Seoul National University. But he was arrested by the police and tortured and died from that torture on January 14, 1987, when the circumstances of his death became known, it sparked an explosion of democratic protest among first the students, then the rest of the population. And that democratic movement succeeded. And South Korea has now been a democracy for a quarter century. And so that additional boost from a positive change in political freedom on top of a big change in economic freedom made South Korea today now a member, one of the newest members of the First World. So the key point is simply this. Many courageous democratic activists know from their own firsthand experience that our technocratic assumption of benevolent autocrats is wrong, that autocrats are not benevolent, that governments are only benevolent after we overthrow the autocrats and replace them with democrats who are forced to respect our rights to protest, our rights to choose our own leaders who are accountable to us. Poverty is not caused by a shortage of experts. It's caused by a shortage of rights. Poverty is not caused by a shortage of experts. It's caused by a shortage of rights. So at this point, you're wondering, so these three myths, I'm arguing really that the principles of development have been wrong. That's a fairly bold claim. And by the way, I could be wrong myself since I'm criticizing all the other experts for being overly confident and arrogant. Well, maybe I'm one of them and maybe I'm wrong. I have to admit that if I'm consistent about my critique of experts, that I could be one of those wrong-headed experts that's telling you something wrong. But what I believe, based on research and talking to many other wise economists that I've learned a lot from and many other wise individuals around the world, is that it's a myth that the technocratic solution is a solution. It's a myth that the blank slate is blank. It's a myth that benevolent autocrats are benevolent. What can you do? Well, if the ideas are wrong, we have now a battle of ideas. You can join the battle. And ideas are a very powerful force in social change. John Maynard Keynes had a great quote that's fairly famous. He said that, quote, "The ideas of economists, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men are usually slaves of some defunct economists." So you can change the ideas that influence the way the world is ruled today. You can join the battle. If you don't agree with the ideas that I've stated here today, that's fine. You can join the debate on the other side. The important thing is that just that we have a debate. What has been happening until now is that there's been a silence, that aid agencies just don't want to talk about the rights of the poor. They just don't want to talk about democracy. The World Bank even has an article in its charter that says it's not allowed to talk about democracy, and a World Bank president has never used the word democracy. Isn't that remarkable? A World Bank president has never used the word democracy, something that's so important to development, and the World Bank is supposed to be in charge of development. And this is not because democracy is something associated with Western values. I think an Ethiopian blogger who had been sentenced by Melist to 18 years in jail and is still in jail, his name is Eskinder Nega, I think he expressed this better than anyone else. He said, "Democracy should no longer be seen as the esoteric virtue of Westerners, but the ubiquitous expression of our common humanity. Tyranny is increasingly unsustainable. It is doomed to failure." And I think he's right. The trends around the world are mostly positive in the long run. We have our disappointments. We have our setbacks. We have lots of bad things happening around the world. But the number of democracies has grown over time. There are no longer as many bad dictators in Latin America or Africa or Asia as there used to be. So let me just wind up by telling you what I believe in after research for this book and what I'm trying to persuade you to believe. It's simply that Individual rights are both a moral good in and of themselves that we should be respecting in development, and they are also the most successful approach to development. So if that's right, then let's be on the side of those fighting for democracy and not on the sides of the autocrat. Let me close by borrowing some inspirational words from Lincoln at a time when our democracy was very much hanging in the balance. He said these very famous words, "Let us hear," and I'm going to modify them a little bit for our situation today. "Let us hear highly resolve that development shall have a new birth of freedom, so that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth." Thank you.
Thank you for those remarks, Professor Easterly. We've been getting a number of questions in that revolve around the implementation of these ideas. And so I guess one thing I'd like to start with is a topical news item from today. And that was, I believe, that Turkey as a country today banned YouTube, having recently banned Twitter. And when we talk about rights, and this is not one of the less developed countries, it's one of the more developed countries, but it is an example of one country using an attempt to squelch individual expression and individual human rights. And I wonder whether you see this as a trend, you know, China banning the use of Google and other outlets. Is there going to be a trend where there is increasingly in the developing world an attempt to deny individual expressions and things like the use of social media? And if so, how does that impact the use of development funds and policy?
Mm-hmm. So, of course, the good news is that the internet is a very positive force for free speech, for dissent, for the spread of democracy, for intellectual freedom, for political freedom. And that's why the governments resisting more democracy are so afraid of it and try to ban it. So it's almost a compliment to Twitter and to YouTube that it's banned by China and Ethiopia and now Turkey. It's very much a compliment. So how do we deal with this in the West? Well, the least we can do is not actually be financing these oppressors and those who are repressing people's rights. I mean, what's really sad about aid is, so to return for the last time to the Ethiopia example, the U.S. aid was, and British aid and the World Bank was pouring funds into Ethiopia during all this time when there was so much repression by Meles. The same is going on, had been going on for so long in Egypt. Many other autocratic countries around the world are being financed by U.S. aid. That should stop. It's just time for that to stop. And let's redirect the aid to those that want democracy, like Ukraine.
Okay. And some of the countries that some of the questions have come in about countries that have relatively high democratic freedom in developing parts of the world, such as South Africa or Dominican Republic and Philippines were cited, but still have relatively, a long way to go with development of economic freedoms. And so have the results tracked along as you've seen these countries going through their path of opening up political freedom resulting in higher economic freedom?
So let me be clear about one thing first, that there's no one is offering any utopian solutions. There are no utopian solutions on the table. And I certainly do never meant to say that you need to reach some kind of utopian ideal of perfect democratic rights before anything good will happen. Democracy is always a very messy work in progress, and economic rights are also a messy work in progress. The two are mutually reinforcing, but they can jump unevenly. You can get a jump in political freedom that doesn't pay off as much as it would have because there's not a corresponding jump in economic freedom, that the majority is still kind of oppressing people's economic rights. But what mature democracies and sort of mature capitalist societies achieve is kind of where both economic and political freedom are high and reinforcing each other. And they're both really necessary for each other. You need political freedom in order to create the conditions for economic freedom. You need economic freedom because, as John Stuart Mill said so well long 100 years ago, you know, if everybody worked for the government, if it was a state-run economy, there would be nobody left to criticize the government. You know, our economic freedom gives us our independence from the government that allows us to be critics of the government and not depend for the government on our sustenance. So economic and political freedom are very much reinforcing. And so even though they will take uneven leaps, to get sustained development, you need to sort of have both move together eventually.
And so in that relationship, that correlation of economic freedom and political freedom, how do you, I guess the question is, how do we know this isn't yet another myth, and that with that greater freedom, entrepreneurs will act in ways that do tend to benefit the poor in these countries and not just themselves?
Well, entrepreneurs, if they're benefiting themselves by making things that poor people want and need, they are benefiting the poor. When they do not benefit the poor is actually when there is some combination of a lack of political freedom combined with lack of economic freedom, that there's some economic elite at the top that's receiving favors from the government and remaining the elite because they receive favors and protection from the government. And I think that is sort of what is happening in in cases like South Africa that you mentioned. So, you know, you really, prevent corporations from doing things that are harmful to other people by having political freedom that stops corporations from doing things like, you know, dumping toxic chemicals into the water supply. You know, we need political freedom to keep corporations in line, just like we need economic freedom to have independent centers of power to keep the government in line. You need both.
Well, as a confessed recovering expert yourself, maybe you could help us understand the roles of large institutions like the IMF and the World Bank, what their varying roles are. And in particular with the IMF policy, some would like to know, you know, since they tend to come with some draconian kinds of recommendations about cutting expenditures and balancing budgets and devaluing currencies and such that can be quite painful in these countries, could you comment about that?
Yeah, that is a kind of coercion by experts that usually backfires. And even if the advice is correct, it usually backfires. I mean, it's backfired in many countries around the world. Latin America has many of these countries. So Bolivia, for example, was subject for years to IMF structural adjustment, and then eventually there was this huge populist rebellion against that threw out, even the good economic ideas to go too far in the other direction. That's how it can backfire when you have experts try to micromanage and run someone else's society. I don't believe that's constructive.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that, in many parts of the world that we're talking about, there are well-established power bases and dictators or leaders of whatever kind, and we have to deal with that reality on the ground as we think about development. And so, how do you see these institutions that are trying to promote development around the world bypassing or getting around that corrupt power structure or dealing with that in the need to develop those countries' economies?
Well, first, I gave you an example at the beginning of the World Bank, the USAID, and Bill Gates praising a dictator. So at the very least, you don't have to praise the dictators. There's one very basic thing that's happening is, sorry, getting hoarse here.
I can talk for a while if you prefer. But I'm not an expert. So.
One very basic thing that's happening is just the wrong ideas are being perpetrated by this kind of praise of autocrats as if they were the heroes of development when actually they're the obstacles to development. You're giving them a kind of intellectual international legitimacy to stay in power, and you're backing that up with even financing from aid. So stop doing that, and spread the ideas of freedom, which will inspire those who are already resisting asserting their own needs. I mean, in the alternative viewpoint of kind of democratic free development, the Western saviors are no longer going to be the star of the show, and they're not going to be the saviors. The people are going to be asserting their own rights, and the best we can do is just support them and be on their side.
Mm-hmm. You talked about a few examples, and I think some in the audience would like you to kind of distinguish. Taking Asia as an example, you talked about China and South Korea, but you've got Singapore as a very different one. And I know in your book you do talk about their leader in a very specific case. Can you talk about that and how an authoritarian state like Singapore has mm-hmm. been so successful?
Yeah, so one thing to say, another thing to say that's the caveat part of the you start off with a simple story and then you start adding the caveats. One of our big caveats as economists is our simple theories do not predict the world perfectly. There will be exceptions. There will be exceptions to every principle. But what does the bulk of the evidence say? The bulk of the evidence says that most rich countries are democracies. And Singapore is almost the only country at that income level that doesn't have oil that is very rich. We could think of other things that could be going on. We could also test directly this idea of the sort of great man theory of development, which the benevolent autocrat approach really is taking, that, Lee Kuan Yew is such a great man that it single-handedly delivered Singapore prosperity. The historians abandoned this sort of great man theory of history a long time ago. The old-fashioned history was that history is just the biography of great leaders. Well, we now realize that's not true, that there's a lot of bottom-up stuff that's actually done by ordinary citizens that is responsible for most progress in our societies. And we have to start abandoning the great man theory of development, and I think there's a lot of evidence that would support doing so. If you do some very simple statistical tests, like when the leader changes, if the leader was so great, then when the leader loses power and we change to a new leader, then the growth will surely fall if the first leader was getting the credit for the growth. Well, you can test that statistically, and the reality is that doesn't happen. In fact, Singapore's growth has continued after Lee Kuan Yew left office. He's very old now and has very little influence on anything, and that's the same in China, the same in South Korea with sequential autocratic leaders that were each given credit for South Korea's growth. But it's more likely that it's something more fundamental that may even not be at the national level. There's a lot of exciting regional stuff going on in Southeast Asia that contributed to prosperity also. The overseas Chinese diaspora was a huge positive force in Southeast Asia, spreading technology and trade from one region to another. And then eventually directing trade, investment, and technology back into China itself. So this is a totally non-national regional force that we don't give enough credit, and we're giving way too much credit to these men at the top who just happen to be sitting in power while good stuff is happening.
Okay. In America, we have a couple of specific examples where we aren't just talking about economic development in some countries, but where we've specifically gone and invaded a country like Iraq or Afghanistan. There's a special set of problems that are left behind. And so can you comment about this year as we plan to pull out of Afghanistan and having pulled out of Iraq already?
I mentioned that the technocratic ideas were sort of used to justify rights violations by the colonial power. And, I think, frankly, I think development is also used as sort of technocratic cover for some of our rights violations and what the military is doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. We talk about things like fixing failed states and nation building, but that's not really what we're doing. We really have an army there that's trying to, find the bad guys that are threatening America. That's really what we're doing. And the technocratic development is just a way to give a kind of benevolent cover to that whole enterprise, which may be a necessary enterprise for the war on terror. That's not my subject tonight. That's not what we're talking about tonight. But it may be that we're just giving a technocratic benevolent cover to those rights abuses that happen with civilian casualties from aerial bombing and drone killings and all that stuff, in the same way that technocratic development had sort of
given cover to colonialists and to autocrats in Africa. So, you know, there's this continuous pattern that development economists are kind of used as cover when poor people's rights are being violated. And we should be concentrating on the rights violations and not on the technocratic solutions.
So taking for a moment the Afghanistan example, as we end the military involvement there, presumably this year, what advice would you have for those who are advising whoever's going to be in charge, depending on these elections which are coming up there? How would you advise the development experts that are going in to that country?
Well, if I was the czar in charge of all the development experts in Afghanistan, I would first fire myself. the reality is the so-called development experts are not controlling anything going on in Afghanistan. What's really been going on all along has really been primarily a military operation for our own perceived security interests, which I'm not going to comment on that issue. And what's going to shake out now is going to mainly reflect local Afghan reality on the ground. I think probably the best that can be done at this point is to offer, if bad things start to happen, offer refugee status to anyone who gets caught in really bad stuff, and try to hold on to whatever good things have been created. But it's not... we cannot pretend that the development experts are in charge. They have so little role compared to the Afghan realities on the ground and compared to the power of the military.
Okay. And in a broad kind of question about the nature of using kind of the invisible hand of the market as you promote development within countries, one observation that's been made by economists and others, I suppose, is that in free markets you tend to have a distribution over time that widens the gap between rich and poor. At least that's a premise. Would you comment on that? And if so, does that figure into this analysis of development?
There is, of course, a lot of inequality in market economies. But I think it's important to distinguish between different types of inequality. And there's one type of inequality that I think is very relevant to tonight's discussion. It's the kind of inequality that's caused by oppression of some groups by other groups. And that's the kind of structural inequality that is precisely part of the discussion we're having tonight about rights. Rights includes the idea that all groups have equal rights. All men are created equal. And so, you know, in the U.S., we still have the legacy and still today have residual practices of blacks being oppressed and being discriminated against. And that's part of the inequality problem between whites and blacks. The same is true in other societies where there are some ethnic groups that are systematically being persecuted by the majority ethnic group that is in power. And that creates huge inequality, not only in economic resources, but also, of course, in the threat to life and person that is caused by potential for violence. So that's the kind of inequality that I think can be clearly addressed by the rights discussion that we're having here, is let's at least get rid of that kind of inequality by recognizing that equal rights for all, protection of minorities, even a democratically elected majority cannot be allowed to tyrannize a minority. There are always basic individual rights that cannot be violated even by a democratically elected majority.
We recently hosted another speaker who was talking about the developing world, but from a legal standpoint more than an economic standpoint. That was Gary Haugen talking about the locus effect.
Yeah, great
and,
book.
And many in this audience might have listened to that program, and I wonder if you could comment, going back to what you were just saying about individual rights. His point was that there are laws on the books in all these countries that give rights to individuals, but they aren't enforced. And then many times the very institutions of power that are supposed to enforce laws are those who are, persecuting people. And so there's a real lack of even the enforcement of the rights that already exist.
Right,
and
right,
as you
right.
think about this from an economics standpoint, and your point is that democracy and individual rights is the pathway to prosperity,
right.
How would you recommend that that people think about the joining of that legal framework and the need to create institutions of law enforcement with the economic framework that you're putting forward?
Well, of course, the problem of abusive and abusive police forces is the worst possible in an autocratic society where there's no possible recourse if the police come and you report a crime and the police are in cahoots with a criminal and they just come and abuse you more, do more violence to you. That's something that very often happens in autocratic societies because you have no recourse. In democratic societies, you at least have a recourse, that if there are, you know, shocking abuses, like there was a World Bank project in Uganda that where soldiers, Ugandan soldiers, evicted farmers at gunpoint from their own land. So here were the security forces supposedly being used to implement development, but they were doing the opposite of development. They were stealing the land from farmers and then selling it to a foreign company and giving the money to the Ugandan government. So in that case, that's a clear violation of rights. If we really recognize the principle of rights, then we would protest those kind of abuses, both when our own governments and aid agencies are involved in financing them. And we would realize that it's only, you know, democracy that makes it possible to prevent those kind of abuses. You can't imagine that kind of story happening in Ohio, for example. It couldn't, or California. It couldn't possibly happen that government soldiers would come and steal your land. Why is that? It's because we have a basic level of recognition of rights in our society, but we're not extending that to other societies, to the rights of the poor. We care much more about the rights of Californians and Ohioans than we do about the rights of Ugandans and Ethiopians.
That brings to the fore another question, which has reached me in several question cards, really talking about our country, and asking for your commentary about democracy and the rights of individuals in our country, and whether or not you know, the poverty that exists in our country and the, you know, the tie of freedom, political freedom, to economic freedom is borne out in this country.
Yeah. Well. So, of course, the U.S. is also still developing, and we're still also democratizing. You know, democracy and rights are always a work in progress. There's never anyone who reaches the utopian state of perfect rights. And so, you know, there are very serious problems in our society that are worsening poverty because the poor do not have enough rights. They don't have enough voice. When there are things like, you know, voter registration laws that make it more difficult for the poor to vote. That is taking away from them their rights. That worsens their ability to protest the bad schools that poor people are stuck with in poor neighborhoods, and that makes it more difficult for them to get out of poverty. So again, the problem is one of rights. When we're taking poor people's rights away by making it difficult for them to even vote, then they will not have that democratic recourse that would allow them to protest bad schools that would be the exit out of poverty. Those are the way that rights are linked to the solution of poverty.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, personally, for you as an expert in this field and with your book, The Tyranny of Experts, you seem to delight in the cutting against the grain of orthodox thought of development economics.
It's the evil side of me, I guess.
And how has it been to stand against the tide of progressivism and the sort of centralist technocratic thought?
Well, it makes some people unhappy, and they let me know it. I try not to take it personally. you know, I'm giving them very pointed criticism, so I deserve getting tough reviews myself. That's fine. The important thing is that there be a debate. You know, the thing that has bothered me the most about this topic is that there really hasn't even been enough of a debate, that there's just been silence, there's been forgetting. Forgotten rights of the poor, the non-investigations of rights violations. This Ugandan example that I just mentioned was just like the Ethiopian example, that there was a promise of an investigation that never happened and nobody protested. The rights of the poor are literally forgotten. So that's what I would at least like to stir up, to do my little part to stir up enough of a debate that the rights of the poor would not be forgotten. Mm.
Well, your book is kind of the opportunity to describe in great detail those fabulous debates that never occurred between thought leaders with opposing views, and it's I think that's one of the real strengths that you have in the book.
Thank you. Say more good things about the book if you want to. You have.
One thing I'm curious about is how has your view been received by those in positions of authority, whether it's in USAID or World Bank or other actual institutions who are charged with doing this development work?
Not that well.
Well,
There is in the works an invitation to go speak at the World Bank after there was an earlier invitation that got mysteriously canceled and rescheduled, but now it seems like it might finally happen. USAID seems to be open to talk. The British Aid Agency seems to be open to talk. Gates Foundation, not so much, but, that's... You know, different agencies are in different positions of how much they can defy critics.
I guess the serious side of the question for me was, you are a noted expert in the field, and you point out some pretty strong evidence, I think, for, the case that some of these approaches haven't really worked. And it doesn't take a real genius to look around the world and say, this hasn't worked all that well for how long we've been doing and how much money we've spent, et cetera. So I'm just kind of curious, do you feel like people... maybe when they're not in front of you are saying, maybe there's something to this, and should we have any kind of hope that this view is going to get some serious airtime with the policymakers?
What I find is it's there's sort of like an age profile to those who are more and less open to ideas. The younger people are very open to ideas, new ideas, to challenges to orthodoxy. Those who are kind of in the prime of their career are not so open. And then after they retire, then they get open again. So I get a lot of support from both the young people and the retirees.
Probably not exactly your target audience.
There's a great saying made by one of our American writers, Upton Sinclair. He says, it's impossible to make a man understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it. Hmm. And that, I think, is the position of kind of some aid agency officials.
One of the questions that I think is on people's minds is here, in the hotbed of technology, we're seeing that around the world, those with access to technology and knowledge of that, those people are being rewarded in the economic sphere, and those who have only their labor are not. And so this, in a way, goes back to this asymmetry we talked about. But could you comment on just what you think, if the technology maybe offers part of the solution here, and access to that might be something you can weave into this kind of democratization?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Technology is very much part of the answer. It's not that the technical answers were wrong. It's just that the people in charge did not have the incentive to implement them, whereas a free society does hold the private and public problem solvers accountable for implementing the technical solutions. And even more, you could say that the most important part of technology is innovation, inventing new things. And that's really only possible in a real free society where you can really challenge orthodoxy, that you can come up with really new ideas that are completely different from anything anyone thought of before. That it really takes a high level of respect for individual freedom to foster that kind of innovation. That's why most innovation around the world has happened in free societies, not in autocratic societies.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the case examples that people may have on their mind is Egypt. And there was a request for you to comment on Egypt as a developing economy and a place that's developing its own political freedom as well.
Well, I guess implicit in that question is, we're all, including the Egyptians, very disappointed at this point that the original promise of the uprising that was, so hopeful and so inspiring, that then led to the current, did not lead to, but then had this setback of the current situation. And, the sad reality is what I mentioned earlier in the talk, that a long history of autocracy makes it difficult to, it tends to create yet more autocracy, and it makes it difficult to switch to democracy. And it's so the fault of the sort of new, the failure of the attempt to transition to democracy in Egypt was not so much the fault of the new Democrats, it was the fault of a long history of autocracy in Egypt that had totally stifled and repressed any democratic culture within which a new democracy could have flourished. Now, that may sound like a pessimistic prognosis. Well, I think one the one hopeful thing about that is lots of other societies have managed to escape that vicious circle and have democratized. As I mentioned, the long-run trends are positive. And, of course, the main recommendation of that whole line of argument is just become a democracy as soon as possible and accumulate as much democratic experience as you can. And then you start to sharply decrease the probability that you will relapse back into autocracy as Egypt has.
Thank you. And we're out of time, so that concludes our program for this evening. And on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I ask you to join me in thanking Professor Easterly for his excellent discussion and remind you that his book, The Tyranny of Experts, is for sale over here courtesy of Books, Inc., and he'll be available to sign copies. Many thanks also to you, the audience, for your excellent questions. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.